Hi, everybody. Cora here. Welcome back to Rev On Air, the Rev On Vera podcast, a place for sustainable storytelling with founders, activists, creatives, and phenomenal individuals who are paving the way for a more conscious future for us all. As we kick off Earth Month 2024, I'm so excited to welcome a guest, Willow Defaba, someone who is working to remind us that change is intrinsic to evolution and that through change, we can truly create a better world. Willow is the co-founder and editor-in-chief of Atmos Magazine, which focuses on climate and culture through the lens of creativity, beauty, and transformation. We will get more into Willow's incredible story and work, but first of all, I wanted to say a quick thank you to our beautiful sponsor, Tubes & Co., for making today's episode possible. Tubes & Co. is a skincare line that is so in alignment with our values here at Rev On Vera, and we are thrilled to share them with you as a perfect destination for all of your sustainable beauty needs. With the skin being our largest organ and the gateway right into our bodies, our skincare products should be made with wholesome, clean, and recognizable ingredients. Tubes & Co.'s entire skincare and makeup range is 100% natural and uses only organic ingredients like tallow, aloe vera, and cold-pressed olive oils. They never use ingredients we at Rev do not believe in either, things like synthetic chemicals, GMOs, toxins, artificial colors, or fragrances. Tubes & Co. is made by a husband and wife team who truly believe that their products are not good enough for you until it's good enough for their own family. With that ethos in mind, the entire line is handcrafted in coastal Alabama. They support small, family-owned farms who are sustainable, fair trade, transparent, and ethical. They use ingredients like tallow from grass-fed cows, organic cold-pressed olive oil, and certified organic essential oils to create their beautiful products. And we are so excited to be able to offer you 10% off your first order with the special code REVPLUSTUBES10. That's REVE plus TOUPS 10. Head over to tubesandco.com to learn more and redeem this offer. That's TOUPSAND CO.com. Trust us, you will not be disappointed with these luxurious and efficacious products. So now, just a little bit more background on my amazing guest today. Willow began work as a fashion editor in New York City for the likes of Vogue and GQ, climbed the masthead at V Magazine, and helped launch the US edition of the French fashion glossy L'Officiel. After several years, burnout set in, and she took some time off to recreate her career path and explore new areas of working. It was at that time that her friend Jake Sargent approached her with an idea of creating a magazine that would be a combination of National Geographic and Vogue. That magazine would go on to become Atmos. Willow's also just released a new book called The Overview, which is an anthology of 100 essays originally published in the newsletter, here arranged under four themes as she considers the core principles of deep ecology: reverence, balance, evolution, and healing. Replete with breathtaking nature photography, The Overview reflects on the many lessons we can take from nature while on our own personal journeys of continuous transformation. I am so excited to share this episode with you guys today as an encouragement to think of how we may be able to embrace change in our own lives to help better help the planet and one another this Earth Month. Now, over to Willow. So, hi, Willow. Thank you so much for joining me. I have been a longtime admirer of Atmos and all of your beautiful work there. And now you've got this gorgeous book coming out and it's an important year. There's so much to talk about. So it's perfect timing. And thank you for joining me. So with all my guests, you know, I really do love to start at the beginning and just hear a little bit about, you know, what sort of brought you into the environmental movement? You know, did you grow up in a house where nature was at the forefront, or, you know, did this sort of come for you more organically later in life? Just walk us through your sort of initial passions and interest in the space, I guess.
Yeah, well, first of all, Cora, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure and honor to be here. I love going right to the beginning. So for me, nature has always been a place of refuge. I grew up in Michigan, and I spent a lot of time in the outdoors. When I was a kid, I was just obsessed with animals and plants and learning as much as I could about this incredible planet that we all share. And at the same time, growing up, I also always knew that I wanted to be a writer. And I had a long-term dream. My parents loved to remind me that when I was a kid, I even said to them, I was like, I would love to be the editor of a nature magazine. It was like so specific as like a 5-year-old. And I think that was really born out of a desire to try to use words to capture the beauty of this planet. And growing up, my career was a bit more winding. I entered the publishing space when I moved to New York, more through arts and culture. And I was really happy that I did and that it worked out that way, because even though those years were very challenging, I think a lot of us who spent time working in around fashion specifically have this kind of wake up moment of reckoning with consumerism and just the sheer volume of stuff that we are filling this planet with. And I definitely had that moment. Sustainable fashion was more and more my beat during that time. And I eventually thought that I was really leaving publishing behind. And I left the job I had been working at for 6 years. And it was then that I met my co-founder for Atmos, and he sort of pitched this idea, well, what if we invited so many of the creatives that the two of us had separately worked with in the fashion space and gave them a platform to use their artistic gifts to tell stories about the environment. And it felt like this perfect intersection of all of my dreams and desires. And specifically, I was really motivated by the fact that storytelling around the climate crisis has always been very data-driven and clinical and documentary. And we really were curious what it would look like to invite creatives and photographers and poets to collaborate with scientists and journalists and try to create a more biodiverse ecosystem of storytellers. And, you know, I never would have dreamed that our first few issues would have Jane Goodall and Yoko Ono, and just having just ranges of people with different talents and ways of talking about the earth that could reach people in a place of heart, because that's what I felt was really missing. Ultimately, the climate crisis is a human crisis, and I think we have to reach people in a place of humanity, which is what the arts have always been for.
Yeah, it's so funny. I feel like even just watching, as you say, like documentaries, it's like it's actually gotten harder for me because now it's like I'm watching these things and I'm just filled with doom and gloom and dread, and I kind of justify not watching them because I'm like, well, I already know. So I don't have to put myself through it. But I was thinking about that mentality because my friend had sent me something and I literally was like, I don't have to put myself through watching this. And then I was like, that shouldn't be the way we're approaching this. Like, it shouldn't be something you have to like survive watching or like gear yourself up to engage with. And for someone like me who works in sustainability and cares so much, like if I'm finding it difficult to engage with that sort of content, then like the average person who maybe is new to the environmental movement or super worried about climate change, that's going to be really hard for them. So how did you guys sort of think about this, like, I want to call it sort of this like open-armed approach to just bringing people in through beauty and for lack of better words, like making it a little bit cool, with people like Yoko Ono or, I think Jane Goodall is really cool. But how did you start to come up with that concept and then execute it, really?
Well, I think, a lot of my background in publishing and working at different fashion and art magazines, I did see that the power that culture has to influence people's minds and to make an issue cool and approachable and something that people want to be a part of, as opposed to something that people feel backed into needing to do, because I don't think that that really works. And so, yeah, the approach was, how do we make it cool? I think someone very, very early on referred to Atmos as like a combination of Vogue and Nat Geo. And I was like, yes, that's exactly what we want to be. It's like, how can we make something feel feel like a movement people want to be part of. And I think so much of that comes down to our contributors. I'm so grateful for all of the different storytellers who've been a part of Atmos over the years, because it's really their gifts that invite people in. And I think that's one part of it. And I think the other part of it is just celebrating the creativity of the solutions and not entirely always focusing so much on the problems. I was speaking with someone the other day about this, and they asked me, well, what do you wish people outside of the environmental movement knew? And I said, honestly, I wish that they understood that the solution, we have so many solutions. We're really being forced down a road that we don't have to go down. But so much of mainstream media just focuses instead on the disaster and the calamity, which is obviously important, but so much of that comes down to clickbait and everything else. We need as many stories that are also celebrating the creativity of the human spirit. And I think the arts really live at that perfect intersection. So that's really one side of it to me. And then the other side, in terms of the open-armed approach, is that I think we need a lot more imperfect environmentalists than we need perfect ones. If we can have a whole world of imperfect environmentalists rather than a few people who do it perfectly, I mean, that's how we're really going to create large scale change. And I think there's so, the story of environmentalism is tied up so much with shame. People think about environmentalism, people hear you're an environmentalist, they hear you work in climate, and they almost, like, I'm sure you have experience with this, they almost like immediately apologize for their like bad habits. And that's really not going to get us anywhere. We need to get over the story of shame. And I think a lot about Brené Brown, the psychologist. She talks about the difference between guilt and shame. And guilt is I've done something bad. Shame is I am bad. And I think we have this story with our species that we are bad. And we need to shift that a little bit more towards, there's healthy guilt and there's healthy accountability. We can feel guilt when we do something that maybe isn't the best approach, but it doesn't have to be that we are bad, because when you're in a space of believing that you're bad, there's really no change that's actually possible. You just become paralyzed in this space of seeing your identity in such a negative way. And so I think inviting people in and saying, like, come where you are, bring whatever your specific passions and gifts are to this movement, whether it's a love of clothes, whether it's a love of branding, whether it's a love of storytelling, there's places for all of those things within this movement.
I love that. And we're going to get into the inclusivity that you guys have really harvested, I would say, at Atmos in a bit. But just picking up on your first point, I feel like, it made me think so much. So, as you know, we just wrapped a collaboration with Farmers Footprint and invited all these different speakers on. And one of the final ones was Richard Christensen, who owns Flamingo Estate. And he just couldn't say it enough. He was like, why we are successful at like, what we do is because we have branded it like a marketing agency. Like he was like, I took everyone from our luxury New York City, like, branding agency. And I said, all right, you were shooting Chanel handbags. Now you're shooting tomatoes like that. And I want the same level of creativity and beauty for a tomato as I want for, what you did for handbags. And it was so funny because until that conversation with him, I think I kind of had thought that before, but he articulated it so much. And like they really have been incredibly successful in this venture. And he was like, I think a lot of people don't even necessarily care, but they love the product because it's presented so beautifully. And I was like, do you think there's problems with people not caring? And he was like, not if they're buying the right product. Like, and it was interesting. It was a really interesting insight. And I think because we're talking about creativity and beauty and all of these things, like, how do you feel about that stance that's like, let's just try and make this beautiful? And if people engage with it because of that, that's okay. Or does it need to be deeper seated? Like, because ever since we had that conversation, I've been thinking about it. And you're the first person that I'm speaking to that actually works in this space of like creativity. And I think it's really easy to put something on Instagram and a lot of people like it because it's like a flower and it's pretty and everybody hits like because it speaks to them, but they might not even read the caption. You know what I mean? Or they might not even like read that, oh no, this is an endangered flower that's like, you know, being, I don't know, swept out or something. So how do you sort of think about that in like a deeper context?
Yeah, I love that question. And, you know, it makes me think because you mentioned Farmer's Footprint, a conversation that I had with Zach Bush about beauty. And he put it really eloquently that beauty is really actually the greatest technology that our species has. You know, we are the species that goes out and seeks beauty. We are the species that stays up to watch the sun sunset. We are the species that tries to create beauty. And I think it's really important when we talk about beauty that we're specific, because I think we have a lot of hollow interpretations of beauty within our culture. But for me, beauty is really the most beautiful things in the world are things that are authentic. So when we talk about marketing and we talk about branding, I don't think that these necessarily have to be dirty words as long as the storytelling, because that's what marketing and branding is, it's storytelling. I just think it has to feel authentic, because people, I mean, at this level of consumerism we've reached, people are very smart and they understand when they're being sold something or lied to. But I think that brands that are really following through with the messages that they're putting out in the world and that are presenting it in a way that is beautiful and speaks to human creativity, I think people can sense that, and I think it resonates. And I think we absolutely need more of that in the environmental movement. I mean, there was a meme going around last summer about how the climate crisis needed the PR team that did Barbie, the Barbie movie. And it, you know, it's funny, but also it's true. It's the climate movement needs PR people. It needs it, and that's part of this open-armed approach, right? Is understanding that, like, we don't need people to like completely quit their fields and start over to become environmentalists. We need people to revolutionize their fields or to bring their fields and their expertise into this movement. And that might be PR, that might be marketing, that might be branding, all of these things, because I mean they play a role in the larger ecosystem.
Hugely. And, you know, thank you for saying that because it really does feel like, you know, we're also in a moment where it is really all hands on deck. Like, no matter where you come from or what you do, genuinely, like any sort of engagement with the climate movement, I think is really just, you know, just so massively important right now. And I guess it kind of leads me nicely into my next question, Willow, which is sort of, you know, and I probably should have done this a lot sooner, but for people who might not be as familiar with Atmos as, say, I am, can you sort of tell us about what your vision was for it? You know, really just like at its base and how you've sort of developed that. I mean, I know when we spoke initially, you said that it kind of was created out of the, I don't even know what the word is for 2020, the unrest of 2020, the need for change that sort of came out of 2020. So can you tell us a little bit more just about the backstory before we get into to anything further in case people are like, what is Atmos?
So Atmos is a climate and culture publication, and our whole aim is really to use storytelling to bridge those two things. So that for me really looks like applying a lens of creativity to storytelling around the climate crisis. That's how we bridge the arts. That's how we bridge climate and culture. And, you know, we started working on the first issue in 2018, I think, and we might have spent almost a year working on it and came out in 2019. It was really kind of a passion project between me and my co-founder, Jake Sargent. And it wasn't until 2020, I think, when our third issue was coming out at the very start of the pandemic, the theme, which was somehow very prescient, was flourish slash collapse. And it ended up hitting the month that the pandemic started. And I just remember it being this moment where we were seeing such pain and death and devastation alongside so much. So much of the human spirit coming through. I mean, I just remember being, I don't know where you were, but I remember being in New York City, and every day at 7 p.m., people hitting their pots and pans out their windows for people who worked in healthcare. And it was like seeing the best of humanity in the worst possible context.
It was the
Not to
same
say
in
it was all,
London. It was the same in London, and I remember it was really depressing when it actually kind of stopped, and then healthcare workers were like facing all these huge issues. But I remember that feeling of like going out, and even though like you like I oddly like we spoke to our neighbors for the first time, socially distanced. Like it was like people we'd never spoken to before. Like we spoke to.
Absolutely. Yeah, I became friends with all of my neighbors in my building. Now we're all friends and we cook for each other. And it created this like return to locality for me in this way that was really interesting. But for me, it was a hopeful moment in the sense that you were left with a feeling that people could actually change. And there have been some depressing moments since, in regards to that, but it was this glimmer of possibility, and I do feel there were so many shifts in consciousness just that year, 2020, and that was when we really decided to invest in Atmos as something bigger than just a passion project, and we hired our digital team and we started putting out daily stories because we just wanted to be part of that change. I really believe in the catalyst of storytelling to shift consciousness. And there was a newsletter. So I write a newsletter called The Overview, which is now being released as a book, a collection of 100 different essays that I've written for it. And one of the very first ones that I put out in 2020, it was comparing the fires in the Amazon, the lungs of the earth, to what was happening to our lungs and COVID. And it kind of went viral. And that was sort of like the moment of just being like, oh, I think that there's actually something here that we can coalesce around, and that's how it's been ever since.
And I feel like I absolutely love how much you take these lessons from nature and you apply them to our sort of our human experiences. And for me, I now my husband and I actually bought a farm in Maine because we were so starved for nature. I've been in European cities for like 18 years, and we sort of actually moved back here, not because I was so desperate to move back to the States, but because we were so desperate to find a piece of land where we could really like homestead and do all these things. And that was very much a catalyst from the pandemic and being so stuck in our flat in London. So I know that you are in Brooklyn, and so much of your writing, I was lucky enough to kind of get an advanced copy of the overview. And it's like, you have these what feel like these very deep connections to the earth that allow you to write in this way. And I think a lot of people that, most of my best friends still live in very urban centers. And a lot of the conversations we have is that it's just very, very hard for them to connect with nature from London, Paris, New York, what be what it may. So how do you like keep that connection going that allows you to write so emotively, I would say, about something that you might not be experiencing in your day-to-day life.
Well, first of all, thank you. I appreciate the kind words. I did an interview with Richard Powers, author of The Overstory, a couple years ago now for Atmos, and he said something that really, really stuck with me because I was so fixated for a while. I was like, I have to move upstate. I have to get out of the city. And he said that he believes the single most important thing that people can do is to live where they live. And that landed with me in a way that I think about it every day of my life, which is we have this idea that nature is something to you have to seek out, to go out, to reconnect with. And it is important. We have to touch grass, and I need that every, I try to get out of the city every so often. But at the same time, reconnecting with nature also needs to be a shift in our understanding and how we think about nature. Nature is everywhere. Nature is cities. And in a lot of ways, cities are some of the most sustainable places people can live because we're occupying less space, shared energy resources, et cetera.
No cars
But
for a lot of people.
no cars, no cars. And so I also think of living where you live as trying to think of where you live as an ecosystem. And so it's getting to know your neighbors. It's going to, for me, it's going to the farmers market every Sunday to drop off my compost. It's starting to shop locally at different grocery stores and learning what's in season, what's not in season. And so I think trying to break down the binary of city versus nature, I think, is something that's been important to me. But all of that to say, I do find the need to get out. And I try to, some of my favorite editions in the book are ones that I wrote after traveling to Patagonia or wherever else, because the actually being in a space and getting to see what you're writing about up close is will always be something that's so special to me.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for that really beautiful answer. And I think that's going to land with a lot of people, just as Richard's, sort of what he said to you landed so well. So thank you. And I feel like the other thing that I really want to speak to you about is sort of what has happened to you over the last couple of years in terms of, deciding you wanted to write a book, going through a huge personal transition. Keeping at most like forefront, you've been juggling a lot of things, and I would love to hear how your personal journey has sort of, whether that's like opened you up to new things, whether that's been more stressful, because I feel like a lot of people, we're all going through our own personal stuff at any given moment, and it can feel overwhelming to be going through huge changes or, huge struggles. And then also thinking, oh, and I have to advocate for the climate and shop locally and do all of these things, So how did you sort of manage that as a journey over the last bit of time?
Yeah, I mean, I would say this is something that's been on my mind so much as the book is about to come out, because the 4 years that I spent essentially writing this book have been the most transformative years of my life, without question. And the full title of the book ended up being the overview, Meditations on Nature for a World in Transition. Because we really realize that that's what this is about. It's about transition. Our world is shifting, our world is changing. Every person in their lives goes through transformations, and life is really kind of this just endless evolution. And our species, blessed with the level of consciousness that we have been blessed with, we have the opportunity to be conscious participants in what that transformation looks like. And there were so, and I'm saying that now from a place of clarity, that I understand how my personal transition and my personal journey is deeply connected to my work. But at the time, there were so many moments that just felt like everything. I always come back to the metaphor of complete metamorphosis that butterflies go through. And there were so many moments being in my chrysalis the last 4 years that I just, it felt like everything was liquefying. And that's what happens to a caterpillar once it's in the chrysalis. Almost all of its mass completely liquefies, save for a few, save for a few dormant clusters of cells called imaginal discs. And those imaginal discs, those clusters of cells, are like blueprints that then become awakened due to a hormone release, a hormone trigger once the chrysalis is formed. And they become the wings and the eyes and everything else. And so what we see is this beautiful process of transformation. From the outside, we just see caterpillar goes in, butterfly comes out. And the reality is that it's mostly a process of decay. It's a process of something liquefying and breaking down. And there were so many moments over the last few years where just my body chemistry was changing, the way I was seeing the world was completely changing, working through past grief, and it really felt like that. And I feel really honestly only in the last 6 months myself kind of coming out of that chrysalis and finding my wings. And I feel so grateful to have been through that, because the single greatest thing that time in my life, this time in my life that I've written this book, has taught me is that transformation is possible. And I have this lightness in my chest that I wake up with every morning, and I wouldn't trade that for anything in the world. And it's almost like I want to like shake our species awake and say, change can happen. Change is actually the only thing we're guaranteed in this life. And for me, this book is, it's a testament to that in my own story, but also in the story of nature, because the more you study nature, the more you study species and ecosystems and specifically evolution, you understand that life on Earth is really just this continuum of change. And so now I think to come full circle and hopefully answer your question, I think there was a period of time where I felt like I was juggling all of these different things, and I just kind of kept living them and I kept moving forward until I reached the point that all of these things were actually not different things. It was all the same thing. And I think it's really interesting that trans people are such we're such a talking point of politics and so much right now. And the reality is that most I was just reading this the other day, most people don't even know a trans person. And yet we've become like the center of like so much political debate. And I think there's like such an othering that happens in that case. And I do think that there's something that comes with there's something about the fixation that for me is tied to change. It's almost this like fear and also this fascination, because the reality is that all human beings go through transitions in their lives. You have probably lived through so many transitions, just as I have. And trans people maybe go through them a little bit more outwardly and a little bit more dramatically. But I think, I hope that people can I hope that people can see a resonance in that and understand that it's all of life is just a process of things trying to become themselves and grow into themselves, and we're not exempt from that.
You know, that's a beautiful answer. You 100% answered my question. And it makes me think so much. The political system here in the States at this moment in time is enough to boggle anyone's mind, that's for sure. But one of the things that I've kind of thought about, you know, is that there just seems to be a real lack of empathy in the world that I kind of don't understand. And it's the same for the environmental movement as it might be for trans people. It's like, you know, I don't know, so, like some of the conversations I've had with people that might not, you know, they're not climate deniers, but they're skeptical. They like the way things worked. You know, they don't think EVs are going to get rolled out. They don't think we can get off fossil fuels, whatever. I don't love to have those arguments because they just get contentious and neither ch side changes. But, you know, my thought has been to sort of approach with empathy, like, don't you feel for the planet, you know, like for the species that are going extinct, for the trees that are being felled, for, you know, and for the water that, you know, is just warming and the creatures in it that are dying from microplastics. Can you not just feel empathy for those things and maybe let that sort of dictate how you feel? And it's the same to me for, you know, the trans community or anyone else. It's like, I guess, you know, are we living in a time where like we can reclaim that empathy? Have we ever lived in a time where there was a lot of empathy? I've been thinking about that notion a lot because I just don't understand where all of this like hatred and hardness and like, you know, separating ourselves from other elements of humanity or the environment like actually comes from. And I don't know if that's something you've sort of unpacked in your work because I've been thinking about it so much.
Yeah, 1,000%, and really well articulated. I think for me, I mean, it really comes back to storytelling, which is, I think something I've learned again and again over the years is that storytelling is actually the ultimate vehicle for empathy, because it puts you in the shoes, the perspective, the life of another human being or another creature. And that changes people. And so I think the more stories that we put out there that can reach people in an emotional place about this planet, about trees, about animals, about the oceans, about trans people, about communities around the world who are impacted first and foremost by the climate crisis, about humans in every walk of life on this planet. I think the more stories that are out there, I think the more, I hope the more empathy that people can cultivate. And I mean, that's my hope with my book, at least, anyway.
I love it. I 100%. And you know, I feel like given that you've just written a book with the title The A World in Transition, you know, another thing that it feels like is happening at the moment is I always I'm constantly like vacillating between being like, oh my God, like there's so much positive like change happening. We're going in the right direction. And at the same time, it's like it feels like there's another side that is just doubling down on like keeping the status quo or like what they believe is the status quo of like what America is or how energy systems run or you know you name it or you know what a marriage looks like for instance what a family looks like you know hanging on to these like with such tenacity these principles and then at the other hand I'm looking and I'm like you can't turn back the clock on progression and we're too far along. But how do you sort of feel about that juxtaposition in the world right now? Because I think that there are a lot of people who are literally like, it can feel really overwhelming trying to balance those two powers that are genuinely grappling with each other.
Completely. And you know, I think about this again to like tie a few of these different things together. It's like, to me, it in some ways makes perfect sense that like the same political party that, you know, attacks trans rights, for example, attacks or keeps us on this path with this fealty to fossil fuels, right? Because in some ways, I think transphobia actually has nothing to do with gender, and it has everything to do with change. It's just this idea, and our species struggles so much with change. We do, and it's like the conservative party is trying to keep us in the past, and obviously, progressive party is about moving us forward. But I think what gives me, and I share the same feeling of sometimes it's just completely overwhelming that it feels like this sort of side is doubling down. But I think what I come back to and where I often feel hope is just that like change is inevitable, evolution is inevitable, and we have to again decide what we want that change to look like. But the idea or the illusion that we can stay over here, that we can stay as things have been, it's a fallacy. And so one way or another, that will be proven wrong. I hope it's before it's too late, of course. But I always think about the ripe symbolism of fossil fuels. You know, people don't actually think a lot about what fossil fuels are and what oil is, but it's decayed, it's old fossil matter, it's decayed life tissue. It's literally old, it's death, it's like clinging to the path in this to the past in this incredibly literal way that is also so symbolic, as opposed to renewable energies. Anyway,
That's super interesting. Actually, so sorry, Willow, can you just pick up on that? 'Cause no one's actually ever said that to me before. So you mean like essentially what fossil fuels are old remnants of, sorry, my science here is horrible, but
decayed matter essentially that's liquefied and under the earth. I feel like I'm going to butcher the science myself, but it's not some substance that is separate from life. It is old decayed matter that has pooled under the earth's surface that is being drawn up and burned and used. But it's just this ripe symbolism for me because it's literally burning the past. It's clinging to the past. It's killing each other over the past, as opposed to exploring what the future could be, which could be renewable and generative. And it's this strange, twisted, it's this twisted reliance on something so archaic and old and dead.
I love that. I really love that. And I honestly think that that will resonate so much with people. And, you know, it's funny how you said, like, it's all about mindset too, right? Like, because this all is nature. I actually had like a carbon expert come on to walk us through like the science of climate. And, you know, he said something, this was 2 years ago, but he said something that stuck with me so much. Like, he was like, you know, carbon isn't even bad. He was like, it's literally a naturally occurring substance that we need in the atmosphere to like grow food. Like it's supposed to be in the soil. like doing its work down in the soil in a great way to like help everything grow and flourish. And you know, he was like, so actually just saying carbon is like the enemy is really bad marketing for the environmental movement, because it's genuinely not. And it was so funny because our whole conversation was so technical. You know, we talked about fossil fuels, we talked about transportation, we talked about methane. And then I was like, you know, his name is Alexander. I was like, Alex, you know, I know there is no silver bullet, but like, so, but if you were going to say one thing that we should be focusing on the most, would it be like carbon capture technology, or should it be everybody getting an electric car or whatever? And he was like, no, regenerative agriculture. And it was this like literally like Wall Street hedge fund guy who turned into like who'd been in analysis basically, and ended up working for like a carbon accounting firm because he wanted to do something differently. And he was just like, the science is undisputable that regenerative agriculture actually is one of our greatest hopes. And I was like, so this is something that everyone can participate in, right? Like the way you buy your food or shop for brands or, you know, grow your own, like that's actually the best solution. He was like, yeah. And it really gave me a lot of hope, because it felt like, you know, for most of us, if somebody was like, oh, the solution is carbon capture, we'd all be like, well, what the hell am I supposed to do about carbon capture technology? But regenerative agriculture, we can all get on board with to some extent. So I feel like, you know, again, I'd wanted to ask you about this. You guys have just sort of brought under the umbrella of Atmos all different types of people, all different types of climate issues, climate justice, climate solutions. Like, how do you think about this in a really like loving, open-minded way? Because, you know, I feel like it's such a, you're one of the only platforms I know that's sort of as inclusive and driven by solutions as you are. So how do you guys kind of, I don't know, keep that going and keep the hope alive and bring up these dark subjects, but also manage to sort of put them in this really pretty way? I just feel like it's quite a success story.
Well, thank you. I think every single thing, the thread of every single thing that you just said is really, it comes down to balance, which is to say, you know, exactly, carbon is not a negative thing. There would be no life on Earth without carbon. And speaking of nature documentaries, I've been watching Life on Our Planet on Netflix, and it specifically goes through the stories of the different mass extinctions on our planet. And I did a deep dive into them for our third issue for Flourish and Collapse. And I always love learning about them because, for me, they are this great reminder that everything in nature is about balance. Because I think it was the second mass extinction that was actually caused by plants taking over the earth and releasing too much oxygen in the atmosphere, which then killed everything else.
Okay.
So it just goes to show that it's not about the thing, it's about the balance of it all. And when we talk about sustainability, what is sustainability? Sustainability is just another word for balance, right? In order for something to be sustainable, it needs to be balanced. And we see that within ecosystems. In order for ecosystems to be healthy, they need to be the right balance of predation, of consumers and generators, and everything else has to be in this perfect, delicate balance. And the story of our species right now is just that we're out of balance with, in regards to life on Earth and what we're emitting, carbon dioxide, for example, methane, everything else. So I think if we can shift our understanding, and again, maybe some of the messaging and the marketing is that we just need to get back to a place of balance. I think that's really one of the most critical things. And I think about that even with the last thing we were talking about politics is, it's not to say the Conservative Party needs to disappear. I think that there's a place for conservatism, and there's a place for progressives to live side by side. The problem is that it feels like there is an unwillingness to meet in the middle and create a balance that I've never seen before. And I think that's really the issue that we're dealing with. And I connect this to your question because, you know, how do we present these difficult subjects and also create hope? It is really just about the balance. I think there are moments and there are times to feel into and lean into grief and collective heartbreak that we might be feeling. We just commissioned a poet for our next issue that'll be coming out in a few months that was a lament for lost species, and it just absolutely broke my heart reading it. It was so powerful. And then we have other stories in the issue that are hopeful and inspiring. And I just think that being a human, being alive right now in the time that we're in, it involves feeling all of it. And it is the flourish and the collapse. It is the beauty and the heartbreak. And that is just part of being human. And I think you just have to present people with something that feels like a full realistic picture. You know, when I think of magazines, I think of the role of publishing is really to present people with, like, it's to capture a sliver in time. And so it would be unrealistic for us to present stories that are only positive or only hopeful. And so I think when we're looking at our editorial calendar, when we're looking at an issue, balance is always the first and foremost in my mind.
I love that, you know, and it makes me think like conversation too. And I'd love to like hear your thoughts on this. It was interesting. I had an experience like living here in Maine. We definitely have a very interesting dichotomy. We're almost 50-50 in terms of being Democratic, Republican. It's you know, a really interesting place to live because I actually, you know, I think when you're in cities, it's actually a lot easier to stay in your bubble because genuinely you kind of just can. Here, I've been like having conversations I never thought I'd have. And I recently had one with a woman, and it was so funny because I definitely lean one way, she definitely leans the other. But when we actually conversed, like with an open mind and respect for each other, I realized like we were actually almost on the same page, but it was like the media, I think, oftentimes can really pull us apart. Like, you know, she was saying stuff that I was like, really? And she was like, well, I don't know. I saw it on Instagram or something. And obviously, Instagram's been feeding her stuff. Instagram's been feeding me stuff. And as a media outlet yourselves with such a powerful platform, how do you guys sort of navigate that space where, like, you know, because it does feel like oftentimes, you know, we're so cautious of this with Rev, like, I always want it to feel like anyone can come there, but equally, like, I want to make strong points. I want our values to come across, but I also want to be really open-minded and allow people to come in that might not otherwise. So how do you guys sort of navigate that with your social platforms? Because it does feel like, gosh, especially going into an election year, the barrage of information is just insane. And also, do you have any tips for people who might be like, you know what, I kind of just need to make up my own mind on things.
Great
Sorry, that's
question.
a big question. I know. It's
No,
not a
it's a good one. You know, I think as much as possible, we try to present perspectives and point of views to let people make up their own mind. I think that's always more effective than telling people what to think. But I think it often comes down for me to trying to think outside the box in terms of our storytelling. I mean, and how we can bridge divides. I'm thinking about a couple of months ago, we commissioned a Republican environmentalist to write an op-ed about what it's like to be part, to identify as part of the climate movement, but be in a part of the Republican Party. And I learned a lot from it. And I actually came up against a number of my own like biases and things that I didn't really realize might be happening within the party. And I think the more we can do that, the more we can understand that, like, oftentimes it is a lot of it's certain loud voices that we kind of assume are speaking for everyone within a group that might not necessarily be. And I think the more we can be critical in that regard, and again, try to reach people from a human place, the better. But yeah, it's hard not to sow. It's hard not to sow division, especially on social media, because social media feeds off divisiveness. The more people argue, the more comments, the more the algorithm likes it, the more the post gets boosted. And that's just the reality that we're kind of fighting against with the platforms that we all operate on.
And it's so funny because I feel like I interviewed Leah Thomas last Friday, as you know, and it was funny because we were talking about this exact same thing, and she was like, it was actually amazing to write a book because a book is just like you put it out into the world and people can kind of like digest it in their own time without feeling this need to like comment on it or, you know, it's and I feel like maybe that could have been the same for you and you can answer that question within my next, because I know we're kind of getting to the end of our time together, but you've spoken a lot about balance in the world. And I think another question that I have that I've struggled with this year, and I'm sure many have, is how you find balance like within yourself. You know, like how do you find energy to reset? How do you you know, take time to consider what are some of your tips for maybe like, you know, when you're struggling from eco anxiety or heartbreak from the realities of what's happening, you know, just any sort of thoughts you have. I think people feel very, even within themselves, very divided and very unsettled. And I'd love to hear if you've sort of gone through any things that you're like, this was really effective for me.
Yeah, I think for me it's I always just come back to nature, and for me nature offers permission that everything has its moment and everything has its place and its time. I think I used to have this feeling about balance that it was about always being in this state of serenity. You know, which is just so completely unrealistic. And the reality is that nature, yes, it's beautiful, peaceful forests and meadows, and also it's tempests and chaos and storms. And I'm much more in a place in my life where if I'm in a space where I'm feeling the grief, if I'm in a space where I feel a storm in me, I let it happen. I let it pass because I know that it will pass. And I think trying to deny it isn't really fruitful. It's not going to do anything. And I let it move through me, and I pass the moments of peace. And so I think about balance less as like a state and more from the lens of a collection of experiences. And so, am I living a balanced life means, am I creating space for joy? Am I creating space for grief? Am I creating space for to be generative, et cetera? And when I think about that balance, I think about, okay, well, if I'm in a space where I'm feeling the grief all the time, then something's off. I may be giving myself too much to my work. I'm not creating space for something to grow outside of it. And that's where I start to shift things. Does that
Okay.
make sense?
It totally makes sense. And you know, that's going to look different for everyone, but I think even just having the awareness to recognize when you are out of balance. But I love the sort of analogy of, you know, like, yeah, even in like a, you know, in a jungle, like it's not always just calm, peaceful birds chirping. There's movements. And so embracing that is so helpful. And yes, thank you. So my final question, Willow, is, you know, we definitely touch upon a lot of dark subjects within the climate movement, but I always like to end with sort of a message of hope. And so my question that I ask all podcast guests to end with is just, you know, what is the thing that's making you feel the most hopeful about the future? And, you know, where are you drawing from that you feel like is something that is just percolating in goodness or excitement for you?
I think perhaps bringing the conversation full circle, I think it is really it's really the lens through which I see everything now, which is just the possibility and the inevitability of change and transition. And I think that gives me hope every day. Every day I study a different creature, and I think about all of the adaptations and all of the branching of the tree of life that had to lead to that specific thing existing. I think about how change is just, it's happening whether people want to believe it or not, or whether people want to be part of it or not. And To me, that always gives me hope. Evolution gives me hope. Our capacity to adapt gives me hope. And we've seen a lot of that over the last few years. And I think that will always be the thing that I come back to, is our capacity to evolve.
Love that. Thank you so much, Willow, for taking the time to share all this wisdom you have. And I can't wait to read the book in full and share it with everybody listening today. So thank you again.
Yeah, thank you so much, Corey. Thank you for the beautiful, insightful questions. Really can't wait to listen to this once it's out.